From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Julia Sweeney, who created the character Pat on Saturday Night Live. She has a new Broadway show. It's a comic monologue about the period when her brother, who was dying of lymphatic cancer, moved in with her and her parents moved in too. Pretty funny premise, huh? What could possibly add to the hilarity? Well, a couple of weeks before her brother died, Julia was diagnosed with cervical cancer. Her new show is called God Said Ha, and it really is funny. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new debut album by the four-women British band known as Fluffy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton addressed the Australian Parliament today. He reaffirmed the United States' commitment to continued involvement in the Asia-Pacific region. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports from Canberra.
President Clinton's address had a twofold theme: the continued importance of the enduring relationship between the U.S. and Australia, and the increasing importance of Asia to global peace and prosperity. Mr. Clinton said the United States' growing involvement with other regions, Latin America, Europe, should not be taken as a sign that it's turning its back on its Asian commitments. He said the U.S. will keep some 100,000 troops in Asia, just as it does in Europe. He also said the United States' reinforcement of its ties with Japan, South Korea, Australia, should not be construed as a threat. That remark was aimed at China, which has accused Washington and its Asian allies of trying to contain Beijing. I'm Vicky O'Hara in Canberra.
A second bomb has been found in the Philippines, near where President Clinton is to meet other world leaders this weekend. It was discovered in an unattended travel bag in the arrival area outside the Manila airport. This comes hours after a pipe bomb was found at the former U.S. naval base in Subic Bay, where 18 leaders will meet on Monday for the Asia-Pacific Conference. The head of Subic Bay Freeport says that bomb was placed there as part of a drill to test security preparations, but other officials say they knew nothing about such a test. The government reports the U.S. trade deficit rose more than 10% in September to $11.3 billion. The increase surprised many Wall Street economists. NPR's John Itzdy reports.
The trade gap widened due to the higher cost of imported oil and weak foreign sales of U.S. aircraft in September. The politically sensitive deficit with China swelled to about $4.75 billion. It was the largest trade deficit with a single country in September, a distinction China is now earning with regularity. That's partly because the U.S. trade gap with Japan continues to decline. However, many economists argue that most of the U.S. trade deficit originates at home because Americans consume more than they produce, making a trade gap inevitable. The U.S. trade deficit during the third quarter was the highest in nearly 9 years. The rising value of the dollar, which makes U.S. goods more costly abroad, was partly to blame. Also, slow growth among U.S. trading partners has dampened the demand for U.S. exports. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
House Republicans have voted to retain Georgia Congressman Newt Gingrich as leader of the House Republicans. The vote was by acclamation. It pretty much ensures Gingrich will again lead the House as Speaker in the new Congress. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 26 points at 6,423. Trading is moderate. This is NPR News. Investigators have found the cockpit voice recorder from a commuter plane that collided with a private plane yesterday in Quincy, Illinois. They hope that the recorder will tell why the accident occurred. 14 people died. The National Transportation Safety Board is on the scene. There's little evidence yet to explain why the crash occurred. There is no control tower at the Quincy airport, and pilots are required to be in contact with each other. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat told a World Bank meeting in Paris today that an economic disaster is in progress in the Palestinian territories. He says this threatens the entire Middle East peace process. David Culhane reports from Paris.
Arafat told a 40-nation financial aid conference that Israel's decision last February to close its borders to Palestinian workers had quadrupled the unemployment rate to 63%. As a result, he said the West Bank and Gaza are losing $7 million a day. Israel sealed off the territories after bomb attacks by Muslim fundamentalists who oppose the peace process. Arafat, the president of the territories, said that output is down this year by 20% because about 100,000 Palestinian workers are still barred from their jobs in Israel. World Bank donors, with European nations in the lead, are here to decide aid levels to the Palestinian territories for 1997. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
Jamaica has posted a hurricane warning for Hurricane Marco, which is expected to strike the island in the next day or so. Marco is about 200 miles south of Kingston. It's moving northeasterly and is expected to shift to the north-northeast. Top sustained winds are clocked at 75 miles per hour, and Marco's expected to strengthen. A hurricane watch is posted for Haiti and sections of eastern Cuba. People are not sure if Marco will pose a threat to the Bahamas. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Rhino Records, producers of Stan Freberg's comic view of history, The United States of America, Volume 1, The Early Years, and the new Volume 2, The Middle Years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember Julia Sweeney from Saturday Night Live? She created the character Pat, whose gender was always ambiguous. Well, now Sweeney has a solo show that just opened on Broadway. And as New York Times critic Peter Marks writes in today's rave review, on stage she has found the showcase for her real calling, storytelling. The story she tells begins after she left Saturday Night Live and moved to L.A. Her brother Mike, who also lived there, developed a vicious form of cancer and came to live with her. Her parents soon moved in, too, to help care for him. And as Mike was close to death, Julia Sweeney discovered she had cancer. While all this was happening, Sweeney was reporting on it every Sunday at a comedy club in West Hollywood called Luna Park, in which the rule was you couldn't tell a story you'd ever used on stage before. Those Luna Park monologues have been reworked into her new show, God Said Ha. I asked Julia Sweeney to perform an excerpt for us.
We were all continuing to help Mike in all of his different therapies, and he was doing really well, with the exception of the spinal tap chemos. Mike had received so many spinal taps that scar tissue had built up along his spinal column and they couldn't access it anymore. So one day we were at UCLA and Mike was on the examination table and my brother Jim was there and myself and my mother and my father, who was reading a 50,000 word essay in the New Yorker all about the plague in India, you know, as a diversion. And the doctor came in and he said, "Mike, this is what I suggest. I think that we should put a shunt into your forehead, which is a plastic opening, so that we can put the chemo directly into the cranial fluid." So, you know, this was just awful. And Mike immediately said, "Listen, Doc, if you think you're going to put a faucet into my forehead, you may as well give me a lobotomy at the same time." And there was this awkward pause. And then my mother chimed in, and she said, "Oh, Mike, I don't think it's like a faucet. I think it's more like a spigot." And then I think even the doctor was a little embarrassed, and he said, "Mike, let me just tell you that my patients who have the shunts, well, they love them." And Mike said, "Oh, they do, do they? Well, then by all means, give me a shunt." And Mike did get a shunt, and after that his refrain became, "I love my shunt." And whenever the doctor would come in the examination room, he'd say, "How you doing, Mike?" And Mike would say, "I'm not doing too well, Doc, but I'll tell you one thing. I love my shunt." And to just show you how surreal things were getting, at night, the whole family would watch shows like ER and Chicago Hope. And whenever anyone would come into the emergency room, Mike would yell out, "Give him a shunt! They need something to love."
An excerpt from Julia Sweeney's new show, God Said Ha, which just opened on Broadway. I wanted to know if she was ever superstitious about turning her brother's fatal illness into comedy.
No, I guess I've always seen the comedy in horror, you know, in the horribleness.
Sounds like your brother did, too.
Yeah, our whole family kind of has that attitude, I think. I didn't really realize that until after this experience, but it always seemed very natural because it wasn't like we were somberly going through the day at the hospital and then I was turning this somehow into comedy later. We were laughing too. You know, I mean, my brother and I were I mean, we weren't in a constant state of laughter, obviously, but there were, I mean, there was terrible things. I don't want to downplay that, but there was also very, very humorous things that were happening, you know, because of the coldness of the hospital or because of the special warmth of some particular nurse or something. You know, there was always something that we found, you know, something we found to giggle at. And so it seemed like those things were the things that I put together for Sunday.
So after all these Sundays of just explaining that your parents had moved in with you indefinitely and how uncomfortable that was, how did you, you know, show up and then explain to the audience, well, the reason why they moved in is that my brother is very sick?
Well, I just thought I just have to come out and say it and not, you know, trying to make a huge deal out of it and just kind of go on, because I realized that the underlying context of my brother being ill and my parents there helped the stories really be funnier. And it was also clearer why I couldn't vent or something with my parents because of my brother being ill. It just added, there was like a big part of the story that was missing by not revealing it. And so finally I said, oh, my parents are staying with me indefinitely because, and I got very nervous. It's embarrassing for me to remember. And I said, oh, because, well, my brother has cancer, ha ha ha, but he's doing really well. And he's very, has a great sense of humor about his own struggle. And we're very close and we're all rooting for him. But here are some of the things that drove me crazy this week about the hospital. And then I would go on like that.
Now, what was happening in your life when your brother Mike got sick?
Well, actually, one thing I don't even reveal in my show because it's so horrible, I don't think the audience would believe it, seriously, is that the weekend I found out that my brother was diagnosed with stage 4 lymphoma was the same weekend that the Pat movie had come out in Seattle and Houston to, you know, disastrous reviews and no attendance by the public. And so it was this very awful weekend. I was just separated from my husband and, you know, I was kind of getting used to being alone. And then this movie was coming out and I was doing all this publicity. And then on the big weekend where it came out and I was getting facts after facts in Seattle of one terrible review after another, then that Sunday night I found out about my brother being ill. And so my whole life in one weekend just changed. And I don't actually put in the part in the show about the show's getting bad reviews because, in truth, it became so inconsequential. Once Mike was sick, who cared about the movie and who cared about the reviews?
Now, how did he and how did you feel about your parents moving in with you?
Well, you know, I say they were with us for 9 months during the show, which it was over the course of 9 months that they were with us most of the time, but there were a few times where we really just sent them back to Spokane because we really had enough. And also my brother would go through periods of time where he felt really great. And sometimes he'd drive himself to radiation and, you know, having cancer doesn't mean you're sick every single second, you know? And so we would send them off and then they wouldn't be able to stand it and they'd have to come back. And, you know, it was very helpful on the one hand because there's so much to do when someone's sick. I mean, there's really a lot of things that must be done. On the other hand, it's your parents doing these things for you again, and you suddenly feel like a child, and, you know, they're trying to help you, and they are pretty much helping you, but they're driving you crazy also. So we were both commiserating and appreciative all at the same time, all the time.
What are some of the things your parents did that would make you feel like a kid again when they were in your house?
Well, my mother, she feels that when she's in her house or the house of any of her children, that everything is fair game. For example, if she wants to reorganize the second drawer of your bathroom, she feels that she should be able to do that. And not only do that, that she's doing you a great service. And so sometimes you would come in and there would be all of these little, you know, Q-tips and safety pins and some Sudafed, and then it would be all over the counter, and then she'd be saying, now why, you know, this should be in the medicine cabinet, and you take a little paper cup and you can put all your safety pins in it. That's what I do when I get my dry cleaning back, and then it goes right there and I always know when I need a safety pin. And, you know, you say thank you and then you try not to strangle her.
Now, did you turn into someone different when your parents were living with you? Did you turn into the child version of yourself?
Yes. In fact, sometimes I would notice my posture would change immediately. Like, suddenly I would feel, I would slouch more, and I almost feel, like, guilty for being taller than them or something. Like, we physically had to suddenly reorganize ourselves so that, you know, I was looking up to them somehow, physically.
Were you ever with them when you were recognized as, you know, hip Saturday Night Live performer, and here you were feeling like a child because you were with your parents and you're slouching to be more like their height?
Well, it's so funny, because when I first got on Saturday Night Live, my parents, they didn't really know what that show was, and it was on way too late for them to watch. So they weren't particularly impressed when I told them I was on the show. But then people would start to recognize me, and that's when they liked it. Then all of a sudden, they knew all about that show. And so then, like, sometimes, you know, I would be with my mother, and she would want to dwell in the moment of the person recognizing me. She loved that moment. So if we were at the hospital and a nurse said, oh, you know, didn't you do that Pat character? And I would say, my usual response was, oh, yes, thank you very much. And now down this hallway is this, or change the subject. And my mother would go, yes, she did. You know, in a long, more drawn-out way so that we could enjoy that moment. So that was also slightly frustrating for me.
It sounds from your show that you really spent so much time with your brother while he was sick, taking him to treatments and just commiserating with him and trying to make him more comfortable. Had you been very close before?
We were close, but we became very close when he got sick. And it's hard to say. I mean, there's five of us kids, and I feel equally close to everyone. And in some ways, it seems really, really close, and in some ways, I wish it were closer. And Mike lived very close to me in Los Angeles, and he worked at the Groundlings Theater where I had also been performing, so I saw him all the time. But he really had his own group of friends, and I had my own group of friends. And then when I was on Saturday Night Live, sometimes in the summers, he would come and stay in my apartment in New York City, and so we kind of switch locations in the same apartment. So we were close in that kind of territorial way, but we didn't become really close until he got sick. And in a way, I'm really, really thankful that I got that time to get to know him like that.
Did he ever come to the club where you were performing the monologues about him?
No, and I so regret that, because I think he would have enjoyed it. But at the time, I was so embarrassed that I was doing this. It was really naughty of me, to me, that I was rushing off to this club and telling these stories. And even though Mike and I were in on much of the comedy about our parents driving us crazy, I still felt like it was too public, and I was kind of embarrassed about it. And I didn't really talk to him that much about it either, and I regret that now.
So it felt naughty, huh, to be doing that?
Well, you know, it's like you spend the week with your parents and then you get that 15 minutes on the phone with your best girlfriend. It's like that. And then you just burst. And then you tell everything that's driving you crazy. And then, oh, you're there. They're coming in again. I have to go. And so it was that. That was my 15 minutes on Sundays.
Did your parents ever want to come and watch you perform?
Yes.
What'd you tell
them?
Well,
they didn't know. I just told them I was going out for drinks with some friends. Oh, I'm revealing myself to be very delusional to people or trying to elude the truth. But, yeah, I would just say, oh, you know, well, see, I was performing improv at the Groundlings, too, on Thursday nights. And so they didn't really understand the difference between doing an improvisational show, you know, where you're making up stuff on stage with other actors, and doing this kind of storytelling type show on Sunday night. So I just made it sound like it was more like an improv show, and they probably wouldn't enjoy it.
My guest is Julia Sweeney. She has a new one-woman show on Broadway called God Said Ha. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Back with comic Julia Sweeney, her new Broadway show is a comic monologue about what happened after she left Saturday Night Live and her brother was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer. He moved in with her, and so did her parents. While your brother was sick and your parents were staying with you, you started to see somebody, a man named Carl. And what was it like to have to almost sneakily have a relationship in your own home after you had already been married for several years? Did you feel like a teenager all over again?
Yeah, it was. Well, of course, I was so angry about it to begin with because in September, I had met Carl. He's the brother of a friend of mine, and he'd come down to visit me, and we'd met. But it was, you know, we just met. And, you know, we spent some time over the weekend together, but we were just getting to know each other. Then he went back to Pocatello, Idaho, where he was living, and we started talking on the phone. And, you know, I figured we were pretty interested. And then we started really talking on the phone a lot, and it seemed very, very interested. And then he said, you know, I'm going to come down for a visit. And, you know, it was in the middle of all of this stuff that was happening. It was actually, I was doing a benefit for Mike in L.A., showing the Pat movie at the Directors Guild. And so, you know, Carl, you know, drove down from Pocatello to L.A. And, it, you know, it was like, so that's September to February, and we're on the phone a lot together. And it seemed like things were going to heat up. Like, this was the weekend, right? And, you know, my parents are there. And it was so frustrating because I thought, I'm finally this woman that I all wanted my whole life to be, which is, you know, I'm single, I'm in my 30s, I own my own home, you know, and I'm ready to have these sophisticated adult relationships that I always believed were possible. And then I finally have this guy that I'm really attracted to. And then, you know, my parents are there. So we're having to, you know, kind of like sneak around and kiss in the hallway. It was just seems so absurd to me. But what I didn't expect was that it was incredibly exciting. And it added this kind of, you know, hotbed of titillation having my parents there that I would never have felt if they hadn't been there,
because we were sneaking around. Oh, because you're sneaking.
Well, you're sneaking around. You know, it's like, you know, I'd have been so many years since I thought, oh, I hear somebody walking down the hallway. Or I'm sure, you know, it's the same excitement that people must get from having an affair or something. It's like you're sneaking around. It adds this incredibly exciting element to the proceedings that you would never feel if, you know, the world were your oyster and you could do whatever you wanted. And in retrospect, it's amazing that Carl and I are still together, given that we Yeah.
Oh,
in fact,
wow.
We just moved in together 2 weeks ago.
No.
Yeah, in New York.
Well, I have to say, though, that in your monologues, although you joke a lot about how uncomfortable it was when your parents moved in with you for such an extended period of time, you obviously really love them. You know, that's always clear.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that there were moments when, like, I would be coming back from the store with my dad, and it would be 9:30 at night, and it was just like a Thursday night or something, and there was no more plans for that night, or we all had to get up and go to the hospital the next day, and I loved it. I mean, I loved it having them there. I mean, it took a while to, you know, kind of break me into the new idea of them being there, but after a few months, I liked it. I mean, I kind of liked that I came home and there was a big group there to hear about what had happened, or I was there to hear what had happened to them. And we were all in this big mission of trying to take care of Mike. And so we had an agenda and we had information to give to each other. And we had, I miss it. I miss it terribly.
When your brother knew for sure that he was close to death, did he talk with you about what he wanted when he died?
You know, he never talked about dying. He never did. And I think Mike believed he was going to make it until really the very, very end. I mean, there was a point at which he lost his speech and he was writing notes saying, let's try these new experimental chemos. He was trying, you know, so hard to do anything to try to combat this illness. And we never had that resigned conversation of, oh, we, you know, you might not win this battle. And when we all realized that he wasn't going to win, we didn't talk about it with him. Or, I mean, we all just felt it, I believe.
You say in your show that your parents sent a priest to deliver last rites. Did he want that?
No. Well, you know, he had a complicated relationship to the Catholic Church, like all of us children have. And, you know, it's like there's certain tenets of the church that intellectually we cannot abide by, yet the ritual is so attractive and it's so much a part of our cultural heritage. And so we were always riding this line between not wanting things like a priest to come to the room and then being very comforted by the priest coming to the room. And so by the time my parents wanted Mike to get the last rites, but they don't treat it like a last rites like you see in the movies where you're just rushing in on the moment of death. They even call it like it's a sacrament called, it's not like reconciliation, which confession is now, but it's like getting better or something. And, you know, it's like it has a positive spin on it, you know? And so it's not to make the patient feel like this is the end, but, you know, let's, you know, join with God to try to help you get better. And so, but on the other hand, it's also the last rites. So when the priest came, I was a little bit mortified because I didn't want Mike to feel uncomfortable by this priest coming in, clearly to give Mike the last rites. Clearly our parents sent him. And I was actually a little defensive, and I arched my back a little bit and probably wasn't as friendly to the priest as I might have been. And then after he received the last rites, then, you know, Mike turned to me and said, actually, I'm glad he came. But that's all he said, and I didn't push it because I got what he meant.
Julia Sweeney, her new Broadway show is called God Said Ha. In the second half of our show, she'll tell us what happened after she was diagnosed with cancer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, announcing a new book, The Planned Parenthood Women's Health Encyclopedia, by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with comic Julia Sweeney about being diagnosed with cancer as her brother was dying of the disease. Her new Broadway show, God Said Ha, is about that period of her life. And Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the British rock group Fluffy.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with more of our interview with Julia Sweeney. Her new comic monologue, God Said Ha, just opened on Broadway. The monologue is about what happened after she left Saturday Night Live and her brother was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer. He moved in with Julia, and soon her parents moved in too to help care for him. Julia, the real kicker in this story is that you were diagnosed with cancer yourself. When,
yes.
When did you get the diagnosis, and what was your brother's situation at the time?
Well, Mike was not doing well. He had had a shunt put into his forehead so they could put chemo directly into his cranial fluid, and that was a horrible thing, although it was supposed to help him. And, you know, it wasn't like we knew he wasn't going to make it, but it didn't look good. And then right in the middle of it, I get diagnosed with cervical cancer, and it had spread to the point where I needed to get a radical hysterectomy, and they wanted to, you know, all sorts of radiation. So it was, you know, sort of a big deal. And, oh, it was just the worst timing. I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it.
Did your doctor know that your brother was very sick with cancer?
You know, this is not going to make him sound like a very compassionate doctor, and I actually liked him very much, but I kept saying, I was compulsive about saying, you know, my brother has cancer. Well, this is pretty strange because, you know, my brother has cancer. Well, you know, my brother has cancer. My brother's staying with me. He has cancer. And the doctor was going, well, you know, what kind of cancer? And I would say lymphoma. And he'd go, well, that's not related to cervical cancer. And I'd say, but still, it's cancer, though. And this is really bad timing, you know. And he didn't seem, I guess when you're a doctor and you're diagnosing cancer a lot, it doesn't seem so profound to you when two people in a family are having it at the same time. And I remember when I got my morphine or whatever it was just before I went under for my hysterectomy, the last thing I said to the guy was, my brother just passed away. My brother just passed away, because Mike had passed away 3 days before my surgery. And sometimes I look back on that and I think, wow, what that guy must have thought. Like, I was just such a mess, clearly.
How did you break the news to your parents that you were sick now?
Well, I actually postponed it for a little while because I felt so guilty about it. I felt, they'd gone through so much and they were so upset and they were trying so hard and they were doing so well. And now, you know, I was being the strong one and we were all staying in my house. And then, I just knew it would be a big deal, obviously. And so I tried to wait until it was really for sure. Everything, all the tests were in. It was just going to happen, And then I told them, and they, you know, their eyes filled up with tears. And then my mom and dad went for a walk around the block. And, it was a bad night.
What was it like to have them there when you were sick?
Well, it was great having Mike there, because he would tease me relentlessly about he would say that I had a cold compared to him, which was true. My cancer was so much not like his cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, oh, you just have a little sympathy cancer. And he would say, oh, you know, now you can join me in the cancer spotlight. And you know, you get served a lot faster in restaurants when you mention you have cancer and so forth, you know, and we really became comrades at that point.
And what about your parents? You're so funny in the show. You say all the other girls got to have their hysterectomies without their parents staying with them.
Well, you know, weirdly enough, I have a couple of girlfriends who are my age who, for various reasons, one because of cancer and one just because of other sorts of problems, had to have hysterectomies, you know, in their 20s. And during that time, you know, they were, you know, one was married and one had her friends around, including me. But I didn't remember a lot of, you know, the parents being there every minute. And so I thought it was so weirdly ironic that I was in this situation saying to my parents, you know, my friends who've had hysterectomies, they didn't have their parents there. They got to go on their own to get it. And it was just like, what's happened to this world?
You're so successful at seeing the absurd side of
what life was like when you had cancer and when your brother was dying, that I think to myself, oh, well, sure, it's easy for her to find material to be funny about. Look, I mean, she and her brother had cancer. Like, well, who wouldn't have good material in a situation like that? What, you know?
You know, I have to say, there were times at the UNCAB, on the UNCABaret, I'm shortening that, so we call it the UNCAB, where I felt so guilty because I realized my material was so much weightier, you know, and people would make remarks about it on stage and they go like, oh, well, sure, you know, here you are, you know, every day, you know, you've got so much material, you're meeting all these, you know, the radiation guy and this guy and this woman and I don't know. I like to think that I see the humor in all of these life situations, but this one just happened to be particularly intense.
Did it help you get through things, do you think, to be able to... When you were sick yourself, did you go back to the UNCABaret and talk about yourself?
Oh, yeah. And it was a lot easier then.
Why?
I mean, well, because, you know, I feel a lot more comfortable talking about myself in that situation than I was talking about Mike and my parents, because even though I spoke of them sympathetically... You are getting up and telling stories about people who aren't there. You know, there is something about it that's a slightly, you know, naughty, as I said, or offensive. And so when it was me, I felt this kind of free rein to really just go nuts talking about it. And I was really graphic about it, actually. And there's a lot of tapes from the UNCAB that I could never do in my show because of the nature of my illness that were really surreal moments. And it was a great therapy for me to be able to get up and vent about it. And I think it seemed to be interesting anyway.
Sure. Whenever you have a problem that's a quote female problem, the opportunity for absurdity in the medical world really enters into things.
Oh, I know. Yes. Well, and you know, it's, you know, you spend your life making certain, you know, your reproductive areas of your body are supposedly very private and, you know,
delicate.
And then all of a sudden, you know, you're just plunged into this situation. I mean, I'm sure it's very much like having a baby, you know, where you're in front of God and everybody, as my mother would say. And, but then it was this, you know, it was the cancer too. And then about not being able to have kids was all, you know, people would just say appropriated or inappropriate things. And it was just... I found it hilarious, but anyway.
You know what I'm wondering? When you're on stage talking about your brother's cancer, your brother's death, your cancer, your surgery, your recovery from cancer, so much of the angle that you see these stories from is the absurd angle, the funny angle. I mean, on the other hand, was there ever a time when you... Surprisingly, I just started to like choke up, when your eyes just started to tear up, when all of a sudden everything that you managed to find to laugh at slipped away and you were left with just the tragedy, the sadness of it all.
Oh, yeah. In fact, while I was writing it, it was never as tragic and difficult as during certain moments while I'm performing it. And in Los Angeles at the Coronet, there would be always a different moment in the show where I didn't know if I could go on. And I didn't want the audience to see me getting choked up, even though I just, you know, I mean, I don't want to be cold and callous about it, but I didn't want to break down, you know. And it was never the moments that you'd think. It wasn't necessarily the moment when I, you know, talk about how, you know, Mike died or when he died or anything. It was like, it's like all of a sudden I'll say we were scoping the hallways for the cutest doctor. Then I'll suddenly be so in that hallway, or when I turned to him, or when I was looking at the LA Weekly and I was reading an article to him, and suddenly it's so real and I can smell it and it's like a virgin memory. And then I don't think I can go on.
But you do.
But I do, yeah. Yeah, it's different times in the show and different memories. And not every show. Some shows I don't have that feeling. But a lot of shows I do.
You know, I'm reminded of what singers often say, which is when you're singing a song, the singer shouldn't be the one that's crying. It's the audience that should have tears in their eyes while the singer just sings the song. Do you feel that way as a performer, that you shouldn't have to actually feel that much what it is? You shouldn't be the one who tears
right out. Well, I think that people are emotionally affected by my show because I don't go there.
Yeah, you know, I don't break down
by the and I let them, because when someone cries, it kind of takes the it relieves the audience of having to or letting themselves feel that way. You know, and it happens just amongst people. If you're in a room with someone crying, you don't necessarily join in. It's like they're having the emotion for you. And I definitely feel that way in the show, that it isn't, it wouldn't be as good of a show if I did cry. And also, I feel as a performer, it's not my responsibility to go up there and just throw myself into all of the saddest parts of it in a real way. I'm there to perform because I'm trying to let the audience go through this experience. And it's better if I don't break down and cry, and I don't.
My guest is Julia Sweeney. She now has a new one-woman show on Broadway called God Said Ha. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Julia Sweeney, her new Broadway show is a comic monologue about what happened after she left the cast of Saturday Night Live and her brother was diagnosed with lymphatic cancer. Then, as he was dying, she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. You know, I have a whole different view of you now. I used to watch you on Saturday Night Live, and I didn't always have a really strong sense of you, you know? And now I've fallen in love with you as a character. Do you know what I mean? It's such a great character. I know it's you, but it's such a great like character you've become on stage. I just think it's really interesting that after being a public figure on Saturday Night Live for a while, that you've now revealed such a kind of personal side of your own story and such a funny way of telling it. I mean, I feel like I understand your sensibility so much more than I did in the Saturday Night Live years.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed being on Saturday Night Live, and it was a big break for me, and it was very exciting, and it was thrilling when Pat became popular, and, you know, it was also frustrating in the ways that everybody knows about. But it wasn't really me, you know, it wasn't. I feel fortunate that in this sort of venue I'm able to get my real point of view across in a way that I was never able to on that show.
Was the success of Pat a blessing and a curse for you? Somehow on Saturday Night Live, sometimes when a character takes off, you have to just like do it and do it and do it, even when you don't want to do it anymore.
Well, it was pretty much all a blessing. It really was on that show, because it was difficult for a woman to get material on, or anyone to get material on. There was a lot of cast members. Mm-hmm. And when you had a hit character, you had, you know, people wanting to work with you. I mean, it was hard. Like, after the first 2 years of doing it, it was hard to think up sketches for Pat. But it was exciting when someone, you know, like Roseanne came in and said, I want to do a Pat sketch, you know, and it was exciting when Harvey Keitel wanted to do a Pat sketch. I mean, that was a great, great situation to be in on that show.
How'd you come up with the character?
Well, I you know, I was an accountant before.
You were?
I was an actress, yes. For 5 years, I was an accountant at Columbia Pictures. And when I was there, there were a couple of people who I kind of melded together to become Pat in my mind. One person drooled a lot. And another person stood way too close to you and was always asking you to go to lunch, and you never wanted to go. And so I kind of mushed them into a person, and then I started doing that person at the Groundlings, and then when I got on Saturday Night Live, I continued doing it, and it was popular.
Well, how did the gender confusion aspect of the character come into play?
You know, it was such an accident, and I wish, you know, in retrospect, it was a genius idea, but in reality, as the idea arose, it was just out of expediency, because I was trying really to be a guy, even though these two people, one's a guy, one's a girl, that I was basing it on, but I was really trying to be a guy, and I just wasn't really doing it very well. And so they, you know, I thought, well, you know, maybe the way to get around this lack of acting ability I seem to have is to really make this gender thing confusing to everyone. And so, you know, people won't say, you know, she really doesn't seem like a guy. So I added that element in, and then, of course, it became the most popular element.
The gender confusion.
Right.
Are you ever going to do Pat again?
I would under the right circumstances. I'm not dreaming about jumping into that fat suit again. But I mean, it's not like people will say, oh, I bet you say you'll never do that character again. Or you know, Pat is dead. And I'll think, oh, you know, I have great affection for Pat. And I loved making the movie. I mean, I stand behind that movie and I loved every minute of it. So I don't know. Maybe not anytime soon.
Julia, how's your health now?
Well, I guess it's very good. I keep going back to the doctors sooner than they want to see me again. And right before I moved to New York, I went and got all of my CAT scans and blood tests, and then everything came back fine. They said, okay, well, you know, come back in a year. I said, really? Don't you think I should come back next month? And they said, not really. You look fine. So I guess I'm fine.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, you're performing your show on Broadway. How does that feel to you, to go from a comedy club to a Broadway stage?
I can't believe it. I can't get over it. I have to not think about it because I can't believe it. But, yeah, on Broadway. When I was on Saturday Night Live, I go to Broadway shows all the time. I was really in love with the theater. And I always thought, oh, I should have dedicated my life to being a Broadway actress. Oh, this is the most wonderful thing. Oh, this, you know, will never happen for me. And now here I am, kind of becoming a Broadway actress, I guess.
But instead of doing Chekhov, you're doing Julia Sweeney.
Yes, exactly. It's not exactly Chekhov. But, yeah, I mean, it just kind of all happened. And it was only in the last couple of months that I knew that I was going to Broadway. I didn't even consider that. And we were actually looking for off-Broadway venues, and it was fine. We were finding it very difficult to get into an off-Broadway theater. And then these Broadway theaters were empty. There was a few. So at the beginning, it started to seem like it was just by default that I was going on Broadway. And my friend Al Franken kept joking with me, saying, you know, I hear if you do well on Broadway, you can make it to off-Broadway. And but now that it is Broadway, I feel like I'm rising to the occasion. I feel like, you know what, this is a Broadway show. So, you know, that remains to be seen, but I'm feeling very Broadway-ish.
Well, this time your parents will have to come see the show, yes?
Oh, this is a fight that's still going on. You know, they saw the show in San Francisco when I did it there. And I warned them vehemently that they weren't going to like it. And I kept saying, you know, I make fun of you on stage. I get laughs at your expense. I don't think you're going to enjoy it. I can't imagine a more worse situation to be in an audience with a bunch of people laughing at something I'm saying you said. And oh, I think you're not going to enjoy this. And then my mother called me and said, you know, we can handle a lot. And I thought that was the greatest thing. And they came to San Francisco and they saw the show and they loved it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I was really surprised. But now, of course, they want to move to Manhattan and see the show 8 times a week, which I think is a little much.
And stand outside the theater and say, that's our daughter performing.
My mom keeps saying, I'm going to do my own show down in the Village called My Side of the Story. Fine, go do it.
That's Julia Sweeney, and her new solo show, God Said Ha, just opened on Broadway. Well, tomorrow on Fresh Air, our guest is going to be Clint Eastwood, and we'll talk about movies he's starred in and directed and starred and directed. He listens to a lot of jazz, as you may know, and he uses jazz pretty well in his films. We're going to listen to a record that he used in Bridges of Madison County. This is Johnny Hartman singing I See Your Face Before Me.
I see your face before me. You are my only dream. There is your face before me. If you could see the magic doesn't matter where you are, 'cause I can see how fair you are. I close my eyes and there you are.
Remember to listen for Clint Eastwood tomorrow. Coming up, the debut of Fluffy, a rock band of four British women. This is Fresh Air. Fluffy is a new band from England that isn't afraid to invoke the influence of 70s punk rock. The group's debut album, Black Eye, was produced by Bill Price, who also produced the Sex Pistols and The Clash. But rock critic Ken Tucker says that this band of four women has an attitude that distinguishes it from its predecessors.
Women in Fluffy are all in their early 20s, but they have the two-decade-old primal punk philosophy of hard, fast, and loud, down cold. Their name, of course, is a joke. There's nothing fluffy about them or their music. I first heard Fluffy on a 5-song live CD released early this year. It was recorded at New York's CBGB's, the birthplace of American punk. You could hear the thrill in the voice of lead singer Amanda Root, so pleased to be treading the same beer-varnished floorboards as the Ramones and Blondie once did. The music on Black Eye is only slightly more polished than Fluffy's live act. It's an ideal showcase for their sound. Fluffy toys constantly with the fundamental rock and roll woman conundrum, which is, of course, girls, doormats or man-eaters. Fluffy likes to make fun of both stereotypes. When Amanda Root sings on the cut I just played, "Tie me down, honey, make me feel secure," she wrings every ounce of irony out of that pun. Root's yelling is so expressive you might take for granted her ferocious lead guitar playing and the precise slamming of drummer Angie Adams. You shouldn't. Look at the pictures of Fluffy on the Black Eye CD sleeve, and note the heavy mascara, the leather pants, and the occasional fishnet stocking, and remember that this was the way that, here in America, all-woman outfits like the Go-Go's and the Runaways started out, as tough trollops. But the music on Black Eye is much stronger, much earlier on in their career. Besides, Fluffy also cites the New York Dolls, men who used to wear dresses and fishnets and play terrific music, as a prime influence, and they include a song here called "Crossdresser." Fluffy really wants to satirize the maximum number of pop culture cliches about sexuality, and on Black Eye, their vehement jokes are real turn-ons.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Purdick, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.